茶屋茶屋胸胸マハムナイエソハ茶屋茶屋胸胸マハムナイエソハ茶屋茶屋胸胸マハムナイエソハ May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness.May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Sem chantam che de wadang deDen park your cheek, Duk ngak dang, Duk ngak gik you dang, Drell wark your cheek.Dewa dang mi drewag your cheek Nye ring chag dang Ni dang drewe tang Yom la ne park your cheek. And then we'll be saying some green Tara mantras and Chin Raisig mantras, which are on the next sheet, which is pink on the first page at the bottom. We'll say seven Tara mantras and eight Chin Raisig mantras.
Om Tare Tu Re So Ha Om Tare Tu Re So Ha Om Tare Tu Re So Ha Om Tare Tu Re So HaOm Tare Tu Re So Ha Om Tare Tu Re So Ha Om Tare Tu Re So Ha Om Mani Padme Hum Om Mani Padme HumOm Mani Padme Hum Om 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 Mani Padme Hum
And so the children can go to their classes. And if this is your first time with children at the center, please accompany them to the lobby, to speak with one of our volunteers. And we're going to do a quick rearrange of the seat in front and then do some prostrations together.
If you'd like to join in prostrations, you're welcome to. If you're unfamiliar with the practice, it's definitely not required, but it's nice to please stand out of respect for the teachings that we'll be receiving in just a minute.
Good morning. I'm Robbie Watkins. I'm a member of the center, and Sarah misspoke a little bit. There won't be any formal teachings today, but there will be a discussion, which I'm here as the discussion facilitator. I'm definitely not teacher. Teacher's a very it's kind of a loaded word in Buddhism to say you're a teacher. Yeah, it carries a lot with it, and I'm not. Definitely not qualified there, but I will lead the discussion this morning, and everyone's encouraged to participate, and if you don't participate, we'll have a very short session. First off, let me find out, how many people are here for the very first time today? Okay, a couple people, great, glad to have you here. And just want to remind people that there is a potluck after the discussion this morning, and even if you didn't bring something, please attend because there's always plenty of food to go around. So let's begin with some meditation. As always, we begin by checking our posture. Our head straight on our shoulders. Our eyes either lightly closed or just slightly open. Shoulders down and back a little bit, so our chest is open. Back is a little bit straighter than we normally sit. Upper arms away from our torso. And we can either put our hands on our knees, or traditionally we put right hand on left with thumbs touching. And our legs are in a stable posture that we find comfortable. The point is certainly not to torture yourself, but a stable posture that will be non-distracting for the discussion and meditation that's to follow. So we'll begin by just taking three deep breaths from the abdomen with the stomach expanding on the in-breath. So our diaphragm is pulled down, our lungs are completely filled. And now we allow our breathing to return to its normal pattern. And as always, we begin our meditation session by setting our motivation for everything that is to follow. And any motivation for meditating is a valid one and a worthy one. If we just want to space out for a few minutes, that's fine. If we just want to calm our mind a little bit, that's great. It said that the most beneficial motivation, both for ourselves and for others, is what's referred to the bodhicitta motivation, the great mind meditation, that even doing something as simple as sitting on a cushion for a few minutes is done with the intent that it will ultimately be of benefit to all sentient beings, to myself, my family, my friends, my co-workers, and ultimately every sentient being throughout the universe. That may seem very unnatural and forced, but even if we can just think about that, that I'm doing this meditation to work on my mind so I can be a better person, so I can better help others, it said that's incredibly powerful. So as much as we can, let's just generate that motivation for a moment. And having set our motivation, we now begin the actual meditation, which is just going to be a simple breathing meditation, just paying attention to the movement of our breath in and out through the nostrils. We just place our awareness on the breath, nothing more, nothing less than that. We're not thinking about the breath. We're not describing it. The consciousness directly experiences breath, in breath and out breath. Every time we notice that our consciousness has wandered away to a thought or a memory or a physical feeling or a plan, we set that aside and come back to the breath over and over again. And we can end our meditation with a simple dedication. We acknowledge that we've done something a little bit out of the ordinary. We sat for a couple minutes and trained our mind. Very simple practice, but that makes a positive imprint on our consciousness. And we dedicate that positive imprint to the benefit of all living beings. Okay. I was informed last week that I'm not to discuss what I was planning on discussing today. I was given another subject by Sarah, our spiritual program coordinator, but I think it's completely appropriate. It's a good discussion to have, and it's not one that we have very often here at the Kadampa Center. Tomorrow is International Sangha Day. Is that the name of it? Okay. Which is not an official Buddhist holiday. It's a, but it's a annual event in the FPMT, the Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition, which is a real mouthful, but that's the worldwide organization that Kadampa Center is part of. And so we're going to talk a little bit about the Sangha, who they are, what their role is, and the incredible benefits of having resident Sangha members here in Kadampa Center. And it's this is a good time to talk about it because Geshe Gelug, our resident teacher, is halfway around the world, and the rest of our Sangha members have certain vows that they can't sit in the gompa when they're non-qualified teachers who are leading the discussion. So they're not here today. So we can freely talk about them behind their backs. The word, if you're not familiar with the word is Sangha, S-A-N-G-H-A. And you'll hear it all every Sunday when we recite the refuge prayer. We say, I take refuge in the Buddha, which is the historical figure of the Buddha who lived 2,500 years ago. The Dharma, which are the teachings that he gave based on his own experience. And then the Sangha, take refuge in the Sangha. And the word Sangha is frequently used in a general sense of everybody who is following the teachings of the Buddha. You know, it would not be inappropriate to say that we have a Sangha here, which is all the members of Kadampa Center, all the people who find the teachings of the Buddha valuable. So we take refuge in each other. And but there's also a more specific meaning of the word Sangha. We could say Sangha with a capital S, which refers to those men and women who have taken ordination, are following their vows, and are living as monks and nuns. And there's a very strong tradition of the monastic lifestyle in Tibetan Buddhism. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that. As we know, the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago. He was a lay person. He had a family and children and lots of riches and everything, which he found, he didn't find what he needed there. So he left them, sat under the Bodhi tree, worked with his own mind, and became what we call enlightened, which means he completely developed his natural qualities of compassion and wisdom. And there's nothing magical or really mystical about it. It's just sitting like we do in meditation and looking at his own mind and developing his positive qualities. And after he had done that, he was not a god. You know, he couldn't make other people happy. He couldn't relieve their suffering. He very quickly realized that what he could do was teach. So he spent the rest of his life teaching in northern India, in kind of the border area between India and Nepal. And he gave his teachings, and first teaching was referred to, as we were talking to, as the first turning of the wheel. Okay, when he taught, is that he turned the wheel. He turned the wheel of Dharma. So he shared what he had learned with other people back then, and he developed followers, he developed students, and out of this grew a tradition, a monastic tradition in Buddhism that's found in all the Buddhist traditions. You know, the colors of the robes may differ. You know, in Southeastern Asia, they tend to be more yellow and orange. In Tibet, they're red. You know, there's Chinese, Japanese, there are the blacks and grays. But there's strong monastic tradition in all the Buddhist varieties that you find throughout the world. As Buddhism developed in Tibet, which is, you know, Buddhism was not originally a Tibetan religion. It was an Indian religion that traveled to Tibet in approximately 500 and experienced some difficulties. But by the 11 and 1200s, Buddhism was the religion in Tibet. And in Tibet, they developed an enormous monastic tradition, these huge monasteries, you know, with thousands and thousands of monks in them. It's said that it's sometimes 25% of the male population in Tibet was monastics. Certainly indication of great interest in spiritual matters, but there are also sociologic factors that affected that. But it's very common for several males from one family to go into the monasteries and spend the rest of their lives there. And the population in Tibet in general was very eager to support them. You know, they didn't see them as parasites or as drones or whatever as you may call them, because they thought that was a very worthwhile use of their own efforts and work to support the monastics. The work of a monastic is basically to study and practice. They're not rejecting the world. They're just eliminating those things that they don't find contributes to their spiritual practice. Of course, and when you have a monastery like that, thousands and thousands of people, it's like a city. And, you know, some of them are cooks and some of them are cleaners and some are bottle washers and everything to support the ones who are more serious about their practice. But in Tibetan Buddhism, the whole point of the monastic tradition is not so much good works out in the community, though they do those, but to support the spiritual practice of the monks. Okay, it's like, I always think of it as some kind of concentric circles, and in the center you have the really serious practitioners, and then everybody else is supporting them. So very strong tradition in Tibetan Buddhism of monasticism. And as we know, when China came into Tibet in the 50s, there were all sorts of atrocities. Lots of the monasteries were destroyed. And a lot of the Tibetans went over the Himalayas to Nepal and India. A number of the monasteries have been restored in Tibet, and they do have monastic communities in them. You know, there's a lot of controversy about whether they're real monastics or whether this is just all being done for the tourists, and for, not that they're getting tourists right now, country's closed down, but whether it's just being done for public relations. There's a lot of controversy about what the actual situation of the monastic communities in Tibet is, but certainly thousands of them were killed back in the 50s. So a lot of the Tibetans came over the mountains. The Indian government very generously allowed them to settle there, and a number of the Tibetan monasteries have been reestablished in India, particularly Sarojay, which is in southern India, where Geshe Gelug trained is, I don't know, how many monks they have at Sarajay now? I think it's like 4,000 monks. And then they have all everything that supports that. So it is a small city in South India. Has anyone in here been to Sarajay? Yeah, yeah. What was it? Tell us what it's like. I've never been.
It's huge. It's like a small city, large campus.
Yeah.
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 Is it on? Hi. Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's like a small city and a large university campus. So there's large dormitories and housing. There's classrooms. There's several large temples. There's nicer houses and compounds for the higher level teachers. And it's set off from a small little Indian village. And then there's one or two other monasteries and a nunnery or where
mm-hmm.
the
yeah.
another monastic university for the nuns that's also nearby.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Very large community.
Yeah. Thank you. So that's one of the largest Tibetan monasteries that's existent right now. One of the Tibetan refugees was. Lama Yeshe, let's see, where's his picture? Yeah, it's hard to see, but he's against the wall there, the top one. Okay, the guy with the big smile on his face, Lama Yeshe, and he went into Nepal in the area around Kathmandu, and he quickly, even though he had not completed the entire course of academic monastic studies, he was obviously quite an inspired teacher. And he had a number of Tibetans who were studying with him, and this was in the late 60s and the very early 70s. And he established a small monastery called Kopan Monastery, which is on a hill a couple miles outside of Kathmandu, and it's originally quite a small monastery. Who here has been to Kopan? I'm sure, yeah, a lot of people. Yeah, it's in the Kathmandu Valley. There's Kathmandu, and then you go to Bodhnath, which is a huge stupa with the eyes on it, and then you keep going and you get to Kopan, which is a little hill, and then you see the Himalayas off in the distance. So he established Kopan Monastery, and one of his major students was Lama Zopa, who's below him, who's of Sherpa origin, and he was his main student, so he participated in the establishment of Kopan Monastery. And in the early 70s, this is when, you know, the hippies and the Trekkies were really first getting to Nepal for the first time, looking for good drugs and other things. And a number of them came upon these Tibetan monks who were studying at Kopan Monastery. And Lama Yeshe had a kind of natural gift for teaching Westerners, initially through translators, but then he very quickly developed his own unique version of English that he could teach in English. So a number of Westerners studied with him at Kopan Monastery. And in the early 70s, they began, some of those who were particularly interested in the Buddhist path of study, asked him if they could become monks also. And there was really no tradition of Westerners becoming monks in the Tibetan tradition up to that point. And he started, he was a rather controversial figure among the Tibetan lamas in some ways because of his openness, willing to share the teachings with Westerners very openly, which was a little bit untraditional. So he got some grief about that. But he began giving vows, ordination, to some Westerners, both men and women. A number of them are still involved in the FPMT. And out of those initial students, some of whom became monastics, developed the FPMT, the Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition, which is the organization we're part of, which is over 160 centers around the world now that basically look to Lama Zopa as their spiritual director and practice Tibetan Buddhism in that tradition. Lama Yeshe is deceased. And the FPMT has always had a very strong tradition of Westerners taking robes, becoming monastics. And we've been the benefit of that here at Kadampa Center. So Kopan Monastery, quite small compared to Sarah J. I'm not sure how many. Anybody know how many monks there are at Kopan now? Do you know, have any idea, Chris? It's not more than a couple hundred maximum, though, I wouldn't think. But it does have a school for young monks. It's kind of the mother monastery for the FPMT, even though most of our teachers actually do most of their training at Sarah J. So Lama Zopa, who is recognized by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, we have multiple pictures of him here, and the Dalai Lama, as you know, was the political head of Tibet in Tibet. Now, he was the head of the Tibetan government in exile. He's given up that role, but he's the spiritual head of all the Tibetan Buddhist traditions. But Lama Zopa Rinpoche has a very close relationship with him. And Lama Zopa does incredible good works in the Tibetan monasteries in India. For example, he provides lunch to all the monks at Sarah J. Monastery every day. He funds that. So he's feeding thousands of monks every day. So he has special privileges. So he is allowed to go into the monastery and pick the cream of the crop and send them to his centers around the world. He can kind of say, I want this one, and this one, and everybody. They're very glad to give him their best students, and the best students are maybe a little bit shocked, but I think they have a sense that they're very special. So in that way, we didn't know this was going on. We had a previous teacher, Geshe Solga, who was here for a number of years, and then he went to Boston. He's since deceased, and we were out without a resident teacher. So I get this phone call from Venerable Roger, who's the Western monk, who's Lama Zopa's attendant, that our teacher was coming in a month. And so that's how Geshe Gelug came here. Geshe Gelug was the one of the heads of his class at Sarah J, and Lama Zopa snatched him up and thought he'd be a good fit for Kadampa Center, and that was about 13 years ago now, and it's been fantastic. So Geshe Gelug is, here in Raleigh, North Carolina, a complete product of the traditional Tibetan educational and monastic system. His family sent him to the monastery when he was quite young, age 7, I think. And, we get his version of things. His version of things was that he was a terrible young monk and a terrible student, nothing but a troublemaker. So I don't know. We don't have any independent verification of that. But that he went through the entire course of Tibetan monastic studies, which was approximately 23 years or so, studying the text, which are on the altar here. And he successfully completed what's called his Geshe exam, which is, Geshe is an academic degree. It's kind of comparable to, it's a PhD of Buddhist studies. So if you're a Geshe, it means you've completed the entire course of studies, you've passed the exam, including an oral examination that's done in public, and then there's a ceremony where you receive your Geshe degree. It's a big deal to become a Geshe. I think out of the 4,000 monks in the monastery, maybe 100 or 150 are on the Geshe tract. You know, they're very much tracked out at a certain age based on their qualifications and abilities. And Geshe Gelug was not only received his Geshe degree, but he received it with he gets kind of PhD summa cum laude. He's called a Lorumpa Geshe, which means he is one of the top three or four of all the Geshes who receive their examination during a certain period of time. So he's considered a Lorumpa Geshe, which is a better than average Geshe even. And then after he did finish that, his Geshe studies, he went to Tantric College, which was another year or two of studying various Tantric techniques. So he is, the completely qualified in terms of Buddhist studies in every way. So he's a Geshe, that's his academic degree. You'll frequently hear the word Lama, which is just means teacher, and you can call anybody a Lama. There's not a committee that decides who's a Lama and who's not. It's just a general term that's used for a teacher. So Geshe Gelug came here, as a Tibetan monastic, and he's been living in the West for the last 13 years. Traditionally, he would have an attendant, which would be another monk who would help him with his meals and all his work and everything like that. And he didn't have one for a number of years until Geshe Sampo came from the monastery. Geshe Sampo has also completed his Geshe degree. He's not a Larumpa Geshe, but he is a Geshe. He was a student of Geshe Gelug's back at Sarajevo. Typically, when the monks get to a certain level, they start accumulating their own students. And their students all live together in a house. Okay, so you may hear people refer to Geshe-la's house. He has a number of students still back at Sarajevo, you know, who are rejoicing that he's here, but they miss him greatly. And the teacher not only is their teacher, but he's financially responsible for them. He provides for the upkeep of the house. He pays for their meals that sponsors aren't doing. So Geshe-la has, in addition to everything he's doing here at Kadampa Center, tremendous responsibilities back at Sarajevo Monastery. So that's why, you know, he always hopes to go back once a year if possible, though he doesn't necessarily make that. So he's here at the bequest of Lama Zopa Rinpoche with Geshe Sampo as his attendant. And in addition to his responsibilities here at Kadampa Center and at Sarajevo Monastery, Lama Zopa is always giving him special projects to do. He's a coordinator for a lot of the Western Geshes. There are a lot of Western Geshes, or a lot of Tibetan Geshes in the West that Lama Zopa has sent to centers in the United States and elsewhere who need some help. The vast majority of them don't teach in English. We're incredibly fortunate that we have the Geshe-la from the very beginning has been teaching in English. Lots of times they're teaching through a translator. So we're very fortunate about that. So those are our two Tibetan Sangha members who are here at Kadampa Center. It's just unbelievable that they're here. And then we also have the great benefit of having some Western Sangha members. And as I say, they've taken ordination. They've taken vows. We have Venerable Chuki. We have Venerable Lamo. We have Venerable Tendrin, who has gone off to Australia to do some studies for a few years. And we had Venerable Chinyi, who died a number of years ago, but was a resident Sangha member here. They're all members, people who just started coming here for teachings. They just came in, you know, they took Discovering Buddhism or came on Sunday mornings and found this incredible connection with the teachings. And in order, all four of them, I'm sure, I'm not trying to put words in their mouth, felt that in order to study the teachings more intently, taking robes would be beneficial. So they talked to Geshe Gelug, they talked to other teachers, they went through the ordination ceremony, and when you become ordained as a monk or nun, you have numerous vows that you're expected to keep. Most of the vows, you don't find out what they are until after you've taken the ordination. So it's kind of a catch-22 situation. But you will notice things like Venerable Tendrin had a vow about when she could eat, so she had to start her meal before noon. There are various vows about conduct. And the whole point of taking vows and becoming a monk or a nun is to study and practice. Okay? It's not to reject the world. Not to get rid of your family and all your problems. You know, I think they'll all admit that you take your problems with you, okay? And it's not like you don't talk to people who aren't monks and nuns, but it is felt that taking those vows, setting certain boundaries of conduct for your body, speech, and mind helps with your study and practice intensely. So that's their situation. You know, there's always some questions about things. They're not supported by the center, okay, or by the FPMT. They don't have any source of outside income. So when they take vows, they're expected to have some plan for how they're going to support themselves. Venerable Lamo continued to work at her job as a nun for several years after she took vows. Venerable Chuki just recently came on the payroll at Kadampa Center for some to do. She's going to be working with us as chaplain and volunteer coordinator. Lavish salary and benefits. I mean, you know, just a pittance. Okay. Geshe Gelug also gets a quote salary from us, as does Geshe Sampo, but they're very, very small. You know, they are not being supported in any kind of lavish lifestyle. So they're not. So I think it's important for people to realize that if you see someone in a monk's or nun's robe, they're not being supported by the center, okay, in an official capacity. They're also not necessarily working for the center, okay. They're not here at the center to do anything that nobody else wants to do. They're here as members of the center, and they come to the teachings and to the pujas and the prayers because that's part of their spiritual practice. Okay? But they're not our servants in any way or anything like that. Sometimes it's easy to think, oh, the nuns will do it. And that's a real mistake. But this is a lifestyle that they figure is most conducive to their spiritual practice. And as a center here in Raleigh, North Carolina, to have two Tibetan Sangha members, two or three Western Sangha members, you know, is just incredible, because it's said that the Sangha members are the true continuity of the teachings of the Buddha. And it's said that the Buddha Dharma only exists in a country if there are, sometimes you hear three, sometimes you hear seven Sangha members. If there are no ordained Sangha members in a country, the Dharma, in spite of all the books you have, does not exist there. If you don't have the teachings, the people who are keeping the vows and trying to live the teachings to the best of their ability. So it's an incredible benefit to Kadampa Center to have these people taking the vows from their teachers, who receive them from their teachers, all the way back to the time of the historical Buddha. And it's something that we can really rejoice in, and it's something that we should think about how we can support them, not just financially, okay, but financial help is always appreciated, but in terms of appropriate behavior around them, helping them to keep their vows, you know, interacting them with a certain amount of respect. You know, I think it's always good to use the word venerable. You know, just don't say, hey, Chuki, say Venerable Chuki. The term venerable is used for monks and nuns as a gesture of respect, not meaning they're old, but meaning they're worthy of respect. I think, Sarah, you wanted to say a few things about maybe, we'll talk a little bit more about ways to support the Sangha, but yeah, a couple of things.
Sure. I just wanted to add, Robbie started to bring up that the monks and nuns are not really supported by the center. And so it's not really a norm of our culture to have monastics interacting with us like this and to have the tradition of financially making them offerings. But that is the system that we're working within. And so it's really encouraged that, because as lay people we work, we have the ability to help support the Sangha, and it's actually considered a very precious opportunity to be able to make offerings to the Sangha. Because of the levels of their vows, it creates an enormous amount of merit to be able to offer them gifts, both of service. For instance, you'll see when the Sangha are here, someone's always bringing them drinks, cleaning the cups afterwards, even helping set up their seats. There's all kinds of small ways that you can offer service to the Sangha, but then also making monetary offerings to the Sangha. And we've been trying to encourage this tradition by educating our members that it's always appropriate, if it's in your heart to make an offering to a Sangha member, to do it at any event. So traditionally it's done at the end of the event during the dedication prayers. So even on a Sunday, if you wanted to make an offering to Geshe-la or the nuns, it's always nice if you're making offerings to one to make them to all. But traditionally, when you make an offering to a teacher, it's usually more. You would put more in your envelope if you're giving money, for instance, than if you were giving to Sangha members who aren't teachers. These are all these little things that are kind of like just assumed that you know. And it doesn't have to be a lot of money. It can be just $3 in an envelope, a symbolic gesture of supporting the Sangha member. And you would put it in an envelope, and traditionally you would use a kata, which is a white scarf, which we have for sale in the bookstore. That's not a plug for the bookstore, but just in case you don't have one. And when we have special events, we encourage people to make offerings by creating the opportunity for everyone to line up and present offerings. We often have loaner katas if you are new and you've never had exposure and would like to borrow one. But even the kata itself is an offering. And so if you had just the white scarf and wanted to offer that, that's perfectly appropriate. When you take it up to a teacher, the teacher will take it, and then you'll see the teacher drapes it over the student's neck, and that's he's basically offering it back to you, and it's considered a blessing. And they often say that when you're making an offering to a teacher, one of the best offerings you can make is the offering of your practice. And so the whole reason why Geshe-la is here and teaching us is because he wants us to see us putting our practice into the daily life. And so it's, again, a perfectly appropriate if you just want to write a card that explains to anyone who's teaching here at Kadampa Center the impact that they've had on your daily life. That really helps create the conditions for them to want to stay and continue to teach us, because it really means a lot to see us actively putting the teachings into our lives and knowing that they're having an impact.
Mm-hmm.
And so also we have what are regular events called pujas. And pujas are basically a long prayer ritual. And it's very traditional at the end of pujas to make offerings to the Sangha with katas and monetary offerings. And that's done during either the dedications or what's called the auspicious verses. And we've sort of been modeling that by, you'll see one of the members get up during that time if you come to a puja, and they'll make offerings on behalf of the center. So you'll see calls for sponsors of pujas, and part of that sponsorship is the offering to the Sangha. And so a small amount of money is taken out of that and presented to all the Sangha members at the puja. And that would also be a time when traditionally the students would get up and make their offerings too. I feel really fortunate that I've been able to travel to different centers, FPMT centers in the country, because I think it's a wonderful kind of eye-opening experience to interact with other teachers, see how other people interact with Sangha. It's very easy to kind of get in the mindset. I know I had this, at least, that when I first started coming to Kadampa Center, oh, this is how it's done. And actually, things change from center to center. So it's really good to have that exposure, and it's a huge education in this sort of how do I interact with Sangha and teachers. And when I was out in San Francisco at Sei Chen Ling, the reason why I bring this up is because there was a very large Chinese community that would come to the pujas. And there, culturally, it's much more normal to have this situation of interacting with monks and nuns. And pretty much every puja, at least half of the lay people, and lay people are people who are not monks or nuns, would get up and make offerings at the end of the puja to the Sangha. And so you begin to see that that's one of the ways that Sangha can actually afford to practice the Dharma, is because the lay people are there showing their support for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just to follow up on that, another way to support the Sangha here is if someone in your family is sick, or there's been a death, or there's some problem, you can individually approach one of the Sangha members and ask them to do prayers on that person's behalf or your behalf and make an offering to them, and they'll be very glad to do that. It's a very traditional way of supporting the Sangha. That's kind of like their job is saying prayers, so we should pay them for doing that. And it's also if you would like to, for example, to have the monks or nuns at Sarah J, the monks at Sarah J do prayers on the behalf of someone you know. That can be arranged through the office here. We can sponsor things there. But I'm just going to throw it open for general discussion or questions about other ways people can think of to support our resident Sangha or benefits that you've seen from having them here, if people would like to jump in and share. Yeah.
We're going to use the mic. Please feel free to just pass it around. It doesn't have to come back to me.
I've always been curious where they stay.
Okay, that's a good question. They take a lot of vows, and a number of them are not accumulating a lot of stuff. Okay, they're supposed to meet their basic needs, but not accumulate a lot of stuff in addition to that. So most of our Western Sangha members, depend on the kindness of others, to quote Tennessee Williams, for their housing. Generally center members will make a commitment for a year to house a Sangha member, and our center members have been very generous, but there's always the possibility of a need coming up there. So I don't want to get too much into the specifics now, but unless they own their own house, which they may before they took ordination, they're going to depend on the kindness of others in general, because none of them are in a financial status to pay rent, full rent. So center members have been very generous there. Now, Geshe Gelug and Geshe Sampo, a student gave them a house. So his housing is paid for, but there's still expenses with that. But he is settling a house. He's not moving from home to home the way some of our Sangha members do.
I found it interesting when Tendrinla was going away, and we were talking, I guess, about, well, where are you going to put your stuff? And I'm thinking, stuff?
Yeah.
And she was talking, little stuff.
Yeah. It's mostly Dharma books and statues and things like that. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah, up here, yeah. You can wait for the mic.
When they take vows, are they specific to them, to where they are in their learning?
Okay, the question is about the vows. And as people know, there are all sorts of vows. As a lay person, you can take the five lay vows, not to kill, steal, lie, sexual misconduct, intoxicating substances. Those are standard. And The vows of ordination that the monks and nuns take, there are what that whole area is referred to the Vinaya. Okay, when you hear the term Vinaya, it refers to the vows of the monks and nuns, and they're different for the monks from the nuns, and there are hundreds of them, and they're different levels. Okay, you take one level and you practice those, and you move on to the next level. Based on how you're doing, you don't have to go to all levels. But those are standardized. They don't change. They're the same for everyone who's taking them. Typically, they'll take them in a ceremony with a number of others, and it may involve traveling to Taiwan or to India or Tibet. There may be several hundred people involved. There are actually more vows for the nuns than for the monks, and the lineage for the nuns of the vows, how they've come down from the historical Buddha, gets kind of complicated. So there's some that supposedly, and I'm not an expert on this, have died out in the Tibetan tradition. The lineage was broken, so they have to go out. The Tibetan nuns. Have to go outside the Tibetan tradition to take some of the vows if they want to get their full set of vows. And then at the same time that they take their vows, they will be talking very closely to their spiritual guide, their spiritual teacher, their root lama, and typically he will give them certain specific meditation practices to concentrate on. In the FPMT tradition, it's very common for Lama Zopa to tell them to work on one part of what's called the Nungne, which are the preliminary practices, like 100,000 mantra recitations, 100,000 prostrations, 100,000 water bowl offerings, 100,000, so on. So he may tell them to work on one of those as their particular practice initially. So there's some variance there, but that comes from your one-on-one relationship with your spiritual teacher, who is the one who basically is giving you permission to take ropes. It's not something that you just do on your own. Yeah. You have to work with a qualified spiritual guide. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Kim.
I found a good way to support them is to say good morning to them. And it's a little awkward saying Venerable Lama or Geshe-la or Venerable Tukyi or Geshe Sampo, but get comfortable with it and say hi and how are you and sort of open up a conversation. Just for 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And then maybe you might say, do you need anything?
Mm-hmm.
And they might mention, well, we do need to get some more chairs in here, and you can one person, two people help out, it's done in a second.
Mm-hmm.
So I think starting a conversation with them just or saying goodbye or I enjoyed that teaching or something simple.
Yeah.
Sometimes helps.
Yeah. I don't think there's any denying that for most people, being a Western monk or nun is difficult in a lot of ways. You know, not just here at the center, but outside the center, you know, living in Raleigh, North Carolina, and walking around wearing red robes and a bald head.
I was uncomfortable going up to them at first. They're intimidating.
Yeah.
But they're
and
people.
So they're real pioneers. You know, nobody really knows how Western monks and nuns are supposed to interact with, or the rules are being made up as they go along. There are some monasteries and nunneries in the West. There's one in France. There's one in Australia where Venerable Tendrin is now. And I'm sure if you ask the monks and nuns, 90% of them, if they had their druthers, would prefer to go off and just stay in a monastery or a nunnery for a number of years, but their life isn't working out, so that's an option. So they're interacting with the society around them, but trying to concentrate on their practice and their studies. I think just acknowledging that they're really making an effort. I mean, they're, you know, beyond, yeah, it's really, you know, really brave in a lot of ways to do what they're doing. Let's see. Let me go to Joanne in the back. Yeah, and then come up to Linda.
I just want to follow up on what Kim said. And it's wonderful to befriend the Sangha and do things with them. Because their Sangha doesn't, as Ravi said, doesn't mean they've completely rejected the society around them. Years ago, Patrick and I took Geshe Tsolga to a Durham Bulls game. And Wooly Bull, the mascot, spotted him and came over and rubbed his bald, his shaved head. Geshe Tsolga loved it, and it really was, for him as a Tibetan, eye-opening cultural experience. And we took Venerable Tendrin to the state fair, which was a lot of fun. And they're wonderful to hang out with. But and I think it's good for the larger community to see robes. Get used to it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. See Linda up here.
Okay, so I have a two-part. One's for Sarah. So at the end of pujas and whatnot, if you make an offering, do you always offer it with a kata, or can you simply go up and put an envelope on, you know, their little table?
You can just put an envelope on.
Okay, and that's completely acceptable. And then the second part of my question is it part of the monastic's obligation to teach or no?
No, there's no requirement to teach. It all depends on what they feel comfortable doing and what their teacher recommends. And that's a good point. Even with the Tibetan monks, okay, for them to teach in, for any Tibetan monk to teach in a Western center, that has to be something that Lama Zopa Rinpoche specifically requests them to do. Yeah. Tibetan monks just can't show up at centers and teach everything. That has to be something Lama Zopa has requested. Yeah. And some, you know, some may, teaching may not be their thing, you know. You know, Geshe Sampo, you know, the ritual arts, and those are, you know, really his natural bent, and that's what he's That's what he's doing right now, okay? So, you know, there's going to be a lot of variation on what the Western and Tibetan Sangha do. Like Venerable Robina, incredible teacher. That's what she does nonstop. You know, and that's what her teachers have told her to do, you know, say, don't do this, teach. That's what you should be doing, and that's what I want you to do, yeah.
I just wanted to add a little bit, too, about one of the experiences I've had that can be very confusing about learning how to interact with our monks and nuns that touches on what several people have said is that some Sangha members have had extensive study and are recognized as teachers and chosen by Lama Zopa Rinpoche to fill that role. And then there are brand new Sangha members who maybe have had very little study in the Dharma. There is a minimum requirement of taking refuge, and IMI sort of guides how long you should study before you become a monk or nun. But just because they've got the robes on doesn't make them an expert. And so part of our role is getting to know them and understanding the difference between someone who maybe is very new to ordination to someone who is a qualified, experienced teacher, and the expectations that we then put on those people, because it can be quite stressful, I think, for a brand new monk or nun to be approached in a way that a teacher would be approached, because they may not have had the kind of study to be able to address the issues that are being brought to them.
I mean, you can assume that the Sangha members who are here at Kadampa Center are here because someone, Lama Zopa Rinpoche or someone else, told them they need to study with Geshe Gelug. That's why they're here. They're here to study with Geshe Gelug. Okay. Yeah.
But at the same time, because they hold these vows, we do have a level of respect that needs to be paid to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's all a part of this learning process. But I encourage what Joanna was saying of, you know, they're regular people like you and me. And I've had, you know, several people who are Sangha members here were my friends. I knew them before they were Sangha members. And when they put on their robes, they didn't just magically become different people. So do treat them just like, you know, people.
Yeah.
When she touched upon new people, here I am. I needed to ask in this microphone, is that okay what I do? Because I kind of grab whoever is around, and I'm forever asking a bunch of questions.
Yeah, that's fine.
I actually grabbed you this morning.
Yeah.
But, I mean, is that proper? I'm trying to figure out the way to go about doing this because it's so many questions and so much to learn.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be a pest.
No, asking questions is fine. I would just remember that the Sangha members probably have other responsibilities, particularly before the teachings.
Mm-hmm.
So you may want to say, can I ask you a question now? And if they say, ask me later, don't be put off by that because they're, you know, they're involved with setting up the altar and things like that. Yeah, but perfectly okay to ask questions, yeah.
So is it a more organized way to ask questions besides writing these notes to Geshe?
What do you think?
Or, is there like a class or something so you don't feel like such a pet?
So, of course, there are classes that will answer a lot of questions, and so there's information about that on the website. But that brings up the issue of when you're seeking spiritual guidance, what do you do?
Yeah.
And so it is definitely a possibility that you can request an audience with a Sangha member in order to have a private interview, to ask questions about your practice. Again, when you're requesting a private interview with, say, the teacher Geshe Gelug, it's important to keep the discussion focused on Dharma practice. How does it affect your life? I know he's kind of half joked that he doesn't quite know what to do when people come to him and say, my marriage is falling apart, I don't know what to do, because he has never been in a romantic relationship. So what's he going to say? But yes, how do you apply Dharma to your relationships is a very appropriate thing to ask. And our Sangha members are available for individual interviews. If you'd like more information about how to set that up, you could just talk to me, and I can guide you through that process.
Okay. Elise.
I just wanted to say that I've been coming to the Kadampa Center for at least 8 years, a long time. And ever since I've been here, there's been a resident Geshe and usually some other Sangha members. And I just kind of, in a way, took it for granted that all centers have this amazing opportunity. But then I look in the Mandala magazine, and in the back there's a list of all the FPMT centers in the world and in the United States. There's quite a few, not a huge number, but a good number in the United States. And out of all of them, I think there are only 6 centers in the whole United States that have a resident Geshe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, oh, my gosh, and Kadampa Center is one of these?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is an amazing, precious jewel and opportunity that we have. And to have 2 Geshe's here and other nuns and other monks here, like, unbelievable. So, you know, we really need to recognize what a precious, unbelievable gift that we have here at the Kadampa Center. Just unbelievable. And so, on the one hand, we need to recognize how precious and amazing that is. But on the other hand, like Joanna and others are saying, they're wonderful people. It's a little difficult. You know, I grew up with nuns and priests in the Catholic tradition, and I think they wanted you to be intimidated. But, you know, it's kind of hard to shake that off. And on the one hand, you don't want to shake it completely off. You want to have, like others were saying, a respect. But it's such a wonderful opportunity to get to know these people that are just like unbelievable people. So please appreciate that too.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, let's see, one in the back, and then we'll need to wind up. All the way in the back.
Hello, I'm here the first time today. Mm-hmm. With my sister. She's here, and I'm from California. We grew up in a Buddhist tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And she told me about this place. I'm here. I'm very impressed and feel totally good about having a Sangha. People
mm-hmm.
are from different ethnic cultures, and here sharing, you know, together. And that's such a wonderful feeling to have, and that's what I'm looking to. The more, you know, into life, the more I'm aged, the more I feel like, you know, the mentality into, you know, the spiritual path is more important, you know, to a person,
mm-hmm.
you know, more than anything else. Each of us has to face tons of things in our life, but in my inner world, I think that the spiritual path and the mentality that we have is what, you know, the core that would bring the inner peace, you know, to the person, and which should be the goal of life. Peace of mind, peace of heart, with a great compassion with all people, you know, not to to look into you know, no borders regarding ethnics or countries, you know, or where we are from. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, welcome. Okay. Let's see. I'm going to wind up. See. Who's doing the... Is someone doing the Donna announcement this morning? Because we have a couple other... I have one that may take a little bit of precedence over it. I just didn't want to steal someone's thunder. Okay. Thank you, everyone, for the discussion. We talked a lot about ways to support the Sangha. Let's see. I wanted to remind people about the Monks and Nuns Fund. Let's see. Who here is it? Joanna, are you involved in the Monks and Nuns Fund? Yeah, Sherry's not here. Is there someone who could? But anyway, this is sponsoring the monks in Geshe Gelug's house at Sarah J. for a year sponsoring them, and it's currently $260 sponsors 1 month for a year. And if you're interested in participating in that, Sherry Satoris, who's not here, but we can get you her number, she runs that. And she also, you see her selling stuff out in the lobby lots of times. She's incredibly dedicated to she's dedicated to Geshe Gelick, and she's dedicated to the students to support his house at Sarah J, and also for the monks and nuns in Mongolia. Okay, FPMT has a very strong connection with Mongolia, where the Buddhist tradition is just being revitalized in a very exciting way. So if you're interested in either of those, talk to Sherry Satoris, and we can put you in touch with her. If you're interested in supporting Kadampa Center, donations are greatly appreciated. Like the monks and nuns, we have no source of outside income. You know, we don't get any money from the FPMT or any big organization. It's all the people who come here who make everything possible, including having our Geshe's here. So that's wonderful. And then kind of emergency announcement. As people know, Geshe Gelick has been traveling in India and Nepal, and while he was there, his aunt, who he refers to as his mother, because his mother died a number of years ago, became terminally ill. And he had to fly her in was an airplane of some kind. I hate to even think what it was, from somewhere up in the Himalayas down to Kathmandu, where she spent a number of days in the hospital there before she died just recently. And he wound up spending about $10,000 in money that he does not have. And anybody who would like to defray those expenses, we've had a number of people who've made very generous donations. This would be money going directly to Geshe Gelick. You can make a check out to Kadampa Center, write Geshe Gelick, or put in an envelope. Those funds would not be tax deductible, because it's just going to be money we're giving to Geshe Gelick. But if you would like to support that, that would be incredibly appreciated. Stephanie Smith has been organizing this over the past few days. It's come up very quickly.
And if you offer cash, just put it in an envelope
and write Geshe Gelick. Yeah, and we'll get there. Okay. So I just wanted to make people aware of those opportunities. And we'll do... any other announcements before our dedication? Yeah, we'll do our dedication, then we'll have our potluck.
So the dedication prayers that we'll be saying are in the prayer book. Thank you. On the pink sheet that's in the front of the book, on the front page. And before we say those dedications, I'm going to read the prayer list. Geshe Gelick recommends that we say the Chenrezig mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, while the list is being read, if you care to. All those killed by natural and man-made disasters, all the Tibetans who have been killed or have taken their own lives in the struggle for religious freedom, the inmate who was beaten to death for being gay, Teresa Brooks, Tina Hyathis, Sarah Roberts Iller, Charles Gregory King V, Donald Moeller, Kendrick Morrison, Tanjiki Sherpa, Jonathan Tagle, Lee Ventura, Dakini the dog, Duncan the dog, Sadie the dog, all of those are prayers for a happy rebirth. For job search, Eve Ehara, Beth Andrew, Gary Kane, Daniel Cunningham, Jenny First, Michael Foltz, Kate Harvey, Andrea Johnson, Wendy King, Catherine Myers, April Rocker, Tony Sloan, Rochelle Thompson, Lori Todd, SS, Anadine Silver, and Sarah. Difficulties of body and or mind, Venerable Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Lama Pema Wangduk, Venerable Chukila, all those harmed by natural and man-made disasters, for the Tibetan people and for the Chinese authorities, may the nonviolent path lead to full reconciliation and religious freedom, the cellmate of the inmate who was beaten to death for being gay, who was also beaten but survived, those, especially the prison inmates who acted with violence, who are struggling with violent tendencies and homophobia, Denise Allen, Jim Barnes, Teresa Brooks' family, Bill Burke, Ron Burroughs and family, Hester Clifford, Herb Cunningham, Allegra Dahlquist, Larry Davis, Carrie First, Mildred Gooch, Davis Helton, Lola Hilliard,
Claude Hollyfield, Leslie and Joan Inman, Sarah Robert Iller's family, Kenny Jackson and Buddy, Andrew Johnson, Bill Johnson and family, Sugi Jones, Helen Kazanoff, Charles Gregory King's family, Kathy Collar, Shanti and Kurt Latimer, Aunt Lori, Alyssa Luck, Carolyn and Granger Marley, Bobby Martin, Jamin Pandya, Lively Pasque, Catherine Paul, Mary Peterson, Aunt Polly, Sarah Noel Quinlan and her family, Duncan Quinn, Richard Robeson, Reuben family, Paula Sable, Rosemary Cease, Tanjiki Sherpa's family, Evelyn Smith, Mamie Stark, David Underwood, Lee Ventura's family, Amy Weintraub, Claude and Vic Williams, Suzanne Williams, Judith Wormser, Casey the dog, Ninjay the dog, and Skippy the dog. If there's anyone else whose name you'd like mentioned, please feel free to say it now. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. The Long Life Prayer for His Holiness. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. And then the Long Life Prayer for Gyumei Ken Rinpoche Jetsun Lobsang Delek, who is Geshe Gelug's teacher. The one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Awatare, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama, ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. And then the Long Life Prayer for Lama Zopa Rinpoche. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And then we'll say seven green Tara mantras for Geshe Gelug's long life and swift return. Om tare tu tare tu re soha.
Om tare tu tare tu re soha. Om tare tu tare tu re soha. Om tare tu tare tu re soha. Om tare tu tare tu re soha. Om tare tu tare tu re soha. Om tare tu tare tu re soha.